In Mark chapter 4, Jesus does something that he does only once. And that is he explains one of his parables. All his other parables, he just speaks, he leaves out there hanging for people to try and work out what it meant. This one he explains, so it must be important. And this is the explanation he gives. Jesus said, the farmer sows the word. So he's talked about a farmer sowing seed. He's now explaining the seed really means the word, the message. The farmer sows the word. Some people are like seed along the path where the word is sown. And as soon as they hear it, Satan comes and takes away the word that was sown in them. Others, like seed sown on rocky places, hear the word and at once receive it with joy. But since they have no root, they last only a short time. When trouble or adversity or persecution come because of the word, they quickly fall away. Still others, like seed sown among thorns, hear the word, but the cares and concerns of this world, the deceitfulness of wealth and the desires for other things come in and choke the word, making it unfruitful. Others, like seed sown on good soil, hear the word, accept it, and produce a crop 30, 60, or even 100 times what was sown. I'm going to come back to that passage right at the end of this morning's message. But I'm going to start off by recapping what we looked at last time. Last time, we took a little time to read through the Apostle Paul's greetings to all his churches. And as we read through those, we noted that every individual church that the Apostle Paul names, he identifies as the church of a household, or the church of such and such a home. For instance, he says, greet Priscilla and Aquila, and the church in their home. Romans 16, verse 5. Again, he says, greet the brothers in Laodicea, and Nymphas, and the church in her home. Colossians 4:15. Or to Archippus, our fellow soldier, and the church that meets in your home. Philemon 1, verse 7. And as these greetings to specific churches roll on, I put forward that we're actually eavesdropping on the real infrastructure of the New Testament church. Because Paul doesn't identify specific churches in any other way. And when we looked at Apostle Paul's general letters, the letters he wanted circulated around all the churches, that's Ephesians and Colossians, we saw that both those letters follow the same schema. They both begin with the grand vision, the big picture, God's ultimate plans and purposes through history. And then when it boils down to the application, to the nitty-gritty, it's instructions to... anyone remember? I've already given you a clue. Yeah, instructions to households. Husbands and wives, parents and children, slaves and masters. These are the relationships where he says the rubber hits the road. Every member of a first century household. And so I suggested that all the structures of church that we're familiar with, congregation, denomination, district, circuit, small group, these are pragmatic structures that exist to serve the church. These are structures that exist to serve the real infrastructure of the church, which is you and me. Christian individuals and families and households. Now, I mention this because sometimes we in the churches get it flipped the other way around. And we can operate as if Christian families and households exist to serve the structures. The purpose of the people of God is to staff the programs. Your purpose in life is to staff the programs. And as you're here, that means our programs. But of course, if all Christians through history had taken that view, there would never have been any Baptists or Congregationalists. They would have all remained in the state churches and served the existing structures, wouldn't they? And we'd have had no John Bunyan, no Charles Spurgeon, no D.L. Moody, no Billy Graham, no Martin Luther King, no Abraham Lincoln, no Jimmy Carter, no Catherine Kuhlman, no Mahalia Jackson, no Al Green. Come on. What kind of world would that be? Seriously. They were all of a tradition that was willing to ask, are our formal church structures serving the people of God as well as they can? Or again, if all Christians through history had taken the view that Christian households exist purely to serve the inherited structures of the church, there would have been no Presbyterians, no Quakers, no Methodists, no Salvation Army, no Pentecostals, and no Vineyard. We would have all remained in our inherited structures and staffed the programs. Well, whether we know the stories or not, whether we're interested in the labels or not, we are part of a tradition within the churches that is willing to ask, are our structures serving the people of God as well as they might? Are they strengthening and supporting our families and households as well as they can? We're willing to ask. We're willing to evaluate. We're willing to fine-tune, because we see the people of God as the real infrastructure of New Testament church. It's the doctrine of the priesthood of all believers. And it's always been at the heart of Vineyard theology and our belief in every member ministry. But back to the story of the New Testament church. Why was the household, apparently, so important? Why was it the bedrock structure around which churches began to gather? Why didn't they jump straight away to much bigger structures? Acts chapter 2 and Acts chapter 4 certainly show there were large numbers of people to accommodate in the church from the beginning. And those chapters also show us that there were wealthy believers and money in the church to do other things from the get-go. And we know from Acts 19 that Christians were at liberty to rent big venues for much bigger gatherings, had they wished to. So, why was the household the bedrock structure around which the church began to gather? Well, I think part of the answer lies in the fact that up until Acts chapter 8 in Samaria and Acts chapter 10 in Caesarea, every church had been a Jewish church. And the bedrock of Jewish faith and practice was, and always has been, expressed from household to household. When there was a temple, which was not all the time, if you lived near enough, Maybe once or twice a year you might go there if you had a synagogue within walking distance. You might go there, but every single week, when the sun went down on a Friday evening, every Jewish household would mark the Sabbath. Every Jewish family would eat together, and every Jewish father would speak blessing over the family and teach the family. Every week, the re-expression of their culture and faith was carried from household to household. And the same with the Passover. Every year, the reaffirmation of culture and faith from household to household. Can you see why that might have persisted? There is great power in that. Power to carry a faith and a culture around the world through wars, through persecutions, with or without state sanction. And I think that is why those first Jewish Christians of Acts and the New Testament instinctively operated church that way. Now, I want to tell you about three families, three households, who showed me, growing up as a Christian, something of the power of the Christian household. And they gave me a vision early on of what I might do once I had a home of my own and guests and boarders and later a wife and a family. So I'm going to tell you three stories. I'll tell you about the Manson family, Tim and Vicky. As a young single person, I often enjoyed the privilege of other people cooking for me in their homes. And one evening, I went to the home of Tim and Vicky. They were a young married couple, and they put on a lovely spread. And after dinner, Tim pulled out his Bible and read a short passage. We each said what we liked about it and what had made us think. And then we prayed. It was really nice. But to me, it felt like something from an older generation. It felt like something from another time. And so I asked them, I said, Tim and Vicky, how did you form this pattern? Oh, said Tim, it's just what my dad always did with us when I was growing up. He said, I liked it and I could see it was something special because a lot of my mates' families didn't sit down together for dinner. Incidentally, that is the definition of a household. The Australian Bureau of Statistics says a household is a group of people who live together and eat together. Is your family a household? Tim said, I could see it was something special because a lot of my mates' families didn't sit down together for dinner, and I was forever having my mates ask for invites for dinner at my house, because they loved the warmth of that family time. And they loved the experience of my dad listening to them and affirming them and speaking blessing over them. And these were my non-Christian friends, he said. I couldn't keep them away. Wow! Inclusion. Blessing, teaching, pastoring, evangelism, all rolled into one in the hospitality of the Christian household. It caught my attention. Let me tell you about the Redmond family. When I'd been a Christian just a couple of years, my home in the UK moved about 150 km to accommodate me for university. But there were still times when I wanted to be around the church where I became a Christian. Times when conferences were on, or times when vineyard teams were visiting. And so I needed some seasonal accommodation. So the Redmond family took me in, and I became part of their extended household. Staying with them as a young believer, I got to see how a Christian family with kids ate together. And it was subtly different to how that young couple ate together, if you can picture that. I got to see how a Christian family with kids ate together and prayed together and did hospitality together and dealt with conflict together, because there were five kids. And I noticed how the wash-up time was a discipling time for their guests. They had a dishwasher, but they used the wash-up time as a time to get alongside their guests and disciple them in whatever way was appropriate. And I noticed how they deliberately brought young Christians, like me, into their home to show their kids a whole range of young and young adult believers, to repeat the Christian story to them in their conversation, and just give them different images of what it might mean for them to grow up and become young adults who had kept the faith. And I saw the intentionality and the disciple-making in all of that. And you can imagine that with five kids, they didn't bother tidying up for me when I went and stayed with them. They simply included me in the real life of their family. And what a welcoming experience that was. It's what's called messy hospitality. Has anyone heard that phrase? I read it in an article the other day. I think it's a wonderful phrase. Messy hospitality. It's what we need to get good at. Simply opening our homes to one another as they are. As the Apostle Paul teaches us in Romans 12. Open your homes to one another. Not a fictionalized version thereof. Or as it says in Hebrews 13 verse 1. Keep on loving each other as brothers and sisters. Do not forget to entertain strangers whenever your house is clean and tidy and you've done a good spring clean. That's the Amplified Bible. But if you go to the Greek, it doesn't really say that. It says, do not forget to entertain strangers, for by so doing, some people have entertained angels without knowing it. No mention of tidying up. So I hope that's a pressure off. And the third family I want to tell you about is the Napier family. If you ever get a chance to read, there's a fabulous book called The New Monastic. Has anyone here not read this book? I highly recommend it. If you read that book, you will find the Napier family in chapter 8. They have a different name in that chapter, but you'll recognize them when you get there. Charles, the dad, was a pastor and a theology tutor. And Jane, the mum, was a music teacher who would tutor individuals on musical instruments at the house. And they had three kids in their late teens, coming into early 20s when I knew them first. These guys were experts at messy hospitality. I don't think they'd be offended if they were listening in and heard me say that. Nothing was put on for guests. Guests were simply included in the normal liturgy of family life. And because they lived in a small town, their relationships were quite layered. What I mean by that is their neighbor was also their friend. Their butcher was also their friend. The owners of the post office were also their friends. The guy who ran the servo down the road was also their friend. And I saw a steady supply of people coming into their home, people of all ages, coming to learn musical instruments, local book readers debriefing after a book with Charles, friends of their kids on vacation from college, or chilling in the front room after a sports match. This was their natural network. I just want you to earmark that phrase, their natural network, because I'm going to come back to that. But whatever the reason you might be in that house, if you were there for the wash-up, then you were being listened to and pastored and taught and prophesied over and blessed and encouraged. They didn't have a dishwasher, and it may have been a deliberate choice because amazing conversations would happen in the wash-up in that home. Everything in the hospitality of that house was charged with disciple-making potential. Now, the Mansons, the Redmonds, the Napiers all modeled for me something that has shaped my ministry as a single person, as a married person, and now as a family man. It's shaped how we shop. It's shaped how we layer our relationships and how we entertain. And it's given me a little insight into why household might have been a structure so well used by the New Testament church because of the blessing it carries, because of its amazing reach. Now, with all those case studies in mind, I'm going to read something to you. These are the words of a guy called Brian Green, who came out from the UK to Melbourne in 1951 for a tour of ministry. And he gave a lecture at the Anglican Cathedral in Melbourne, which I'm going to quote from. Before I read it, I want you to bear in mind that these are words from 1951. And so he speaks unselfconsciously about marriage, households of husbands and wives. But I want you to hear it and translate it for whatever is your context, whether you're in a household of one, or a household of two, or a family, or a group house, or any combination. So this is what he says. I want to speak of an idea which ought to constitute the greatest single evangelistic agency at work today, and it is the Christian home. And then he quotes, I'm using the Christian home in this context as a unit in the evangelistic enterprise of Christ's church. I'm not thinking of the generally beneficial influence of a nice home. I'm thinking of the husband and wife living together in such oneness of intention that their main concern is not themselves, but the kingdom of God. And as such, they see their home as a place which is always open. The grace of hospitality is for them not just an addition, but the very essence of their lives. Such homes are places in which men and women are finding God. The key is to be found in the threefold cord of a happily married life, a home which breathes the quietness of God, and the ability of the husband and wife to play their part in interpreting the gospel so that the stranger is converted. Why this unit in the church's program is so vital is that it can be multiplied indefinitely. It needs for its use neither learning nor wealth, only love. I maintain from my observation that this quality of home contains the richest thing the church has to offer the world, and it is the surest guarantee that the gates of hell can never prevail against it. In a family circle, which is never a closed circle, in the table, which always has an extra place, there is a microcosm of the true community which can transform a neighborhood, revive a nation, and save a world. When we have the time and energy to live with that oneness of intention, to use his phrase, then how our households engage with our natural networks suddenly takes on an amazing potential. Probably the most commonly advertised church position in 2016, and it's been that way for a few years, was a position called a children's and families worker. I don't know if you've ever read an advert for these positions, which are very commonly being called for. I've read a few, and they all sound something a bit like this. The First Church of Glorious Pentecost, vacancy. We are a friendly church of 72 households with a weekly attendance of 120 to 150. We are a mix of ages, perhaps a few more older than younger. Our challenge is that as a congregation, we have no fringe. We meet in a recreation room on the 19th floor of an office block, and so we're not very visible to passers-by. Also, we've lost contact with the wider community, and especially with a non-churched generation of young families. The job of the children's and families worker will be to fix that. These adverts stay in the press month after month after month. I have no idea why. Now, if we look at the First Church of Glorious Pentecost, not its real name, through congregation-shaped lenses, we might have to agree. They don't have much fringe. They don't have much visibility. Perhaps they have lost contact with the wider community. But wait a minute. What if we take our congregation-shaped lenses off and put our household-shaped lenses on and look again? What did they say? We are a church of 72 households, a mix of ages. All right. Let's say that each of their households is on average three people. I mean, there may be some with five kids in them. There may be some single-person households. Let's say it averages out each of their households three people. Let's start thinking about their natural networks. Friends, neighbors, colleagues, people they buy from on a regular basis in their shops, people they do business with, kids they go to school with, teammates in their sports activities, people they work with, people they play lawn bowls with, people they tutor. Let's say, for the sake of argument, each person has 12 people in their life on those various tickets. Seen that way, through a household-shaped lens, through a natural networks lens, the First Church of Glorious Pentecost has a fringe not of zero, but if my mental arithmetic is right, of about 2,592 people. They have not lost contact with the wider community. They're in contact every single week. They just had the wrong lenses on. The critical thing for the First Church of Glorious Pentecost is not getting their children's and families' worker to fix it, but to get the vision and energy to respond to all that world of opportunity that God has given them. With the time and energy, those 72 households have phenomenal outreach potential. Now, one person who understood this was Nikita Khrushchev, who presided over the Soviet Union in the late 50s and early 60s. And I say that because what did he do when he wanted to shut Christianity down? Well, the first thing he did was to close any church like this one that believes in the priesthood of all believers. Got rid of them. The other churches were allowed to stay, and they were allowed to do anything they wanted on a Sunday. They could preach from the Bible. They could speak of solidarity, and they could teach about Christian counterculture. The authorities were unworried. But if you taught a Bible study in your home with people who were not members of your family, or convened a life group in your apartment, or tried to do a kids' discipleship group in your living room, that's what would land you in the gulag. Now, isn't that interesting? Because Khrushchev tried to do the much harder thing of shutting down what Christian households could do in private. And he did that because that was where he perceived the greatest threat. That was what he saw as the greatest danger in terms of an ability to spread the culture of the Christian faith. Now, there's a lesson in that. And that's why I began with those words of Jesus from Mark chapter 4, because it's really in our private life, in our home life, that we get tripped up and turned around by adversity and hardships. It's in our private life, our home life, that we get pressured and stressed out and overstretched by the cares and concerns of this world and the deceitfulness of wealth and the desire for more things. That's where it all happens and presses in on us. And whatever puts pressure on our households, whatever diminishes our life as families and households, diminishes our life as a congregation and diminishes our potential in mission and ministry. If the First Church of Glorious Pentecost comprises 72 exhausted households, or 72 overscheduled households, or 72 stressed or depressed households, then yes, perhaps their fringe is closer to zero. But if it's 72 doing okay households, 72 energetic, hospitable households, then their fringe is 2,592 people approximately. Ready to enjoy that hospitality, ready to enjoy that wash up time, all the potential of that. So this morning, I want to boil all this down to two very simple questions. Here's the first. As for you and your household, how are you doing? And the second question. As for us as a congregation, how are we going at supporting and guiding and helping each other each other's households as we wrestle with the cares and concerns of this world. How are we going at looking after each other at that level? Let's pause there.